So if you think about it, the courthouse doors usually open at like 8:30 a.m.
Right, standard business hours.
Yeah, standard hours. The gavels come down during daylight, and by 5 during p.m., the whole administrative machinery of the justice system pretty much just shuts down for the night.
It does. The clerks go home, the judges take off their robes.
Exactly. The doors are literally locked. But here is the terrifying reality. Danger doesn't punch a clock.
No, it certainly doesn't.
A crisis doesn't wait for Monday morning. So what exactly happens at, say, 2:00 a.m. on a Sunday when someone is in immediate terrifying danger?
When they desperately need a legal shield right then and there.
Right. How does the law protect you when the building that dispenses justice is literally locked and empty?
Well, it is genuinely one of the most compelling logistical and constitutional puzzles in the entire legal system.
I can imagine.
Yeah, because you are looking at this profound razor-thin tension. On one hand, you have a terrified individual needing an immediate life-saving intervention.
Literally a matter of life and death sometimes.
Exactly. But on the other hand, you have the absolute bedrock necessity of upholding the strict constitutional requirements of due process.
Right, because you can't just bypass the United States Constitution just because it happens to be dark outside.
Or because the clerks went home. You just can't do it.
And navigating that exact tension is our mission for today's deep dive. We are deciphering a fascinating, deeply critical piece of legal machinery from Pennsylvania.
Specifically, we've got our hands on Section 14 of the Minor Court Education Board's study aid on emergency protective relief.
Yes, and we are going to figure out how this sort of shadow system of after-hours justice actually works.
That's a really intricate system.
It is. But looking through these documents, I mean, it seems like before a victim can even figure out where to get help in the middle of the night, they first have to navigate the system to figure out what kind of help they actually qualify for.
That's the very first hurdle, yes.
Because the source material draws a very hard line, splitting emergency protection into two totally distinct categories. We've got the PFA and the PFSVI.
Right, and that division is very deliberate. So let's start with the first one.
The PFA.
Yeah, the PFA, which stands for Protection from Abuse. Now, this legal mechanism is strictly tethered to the relationship between the people involved.
Okay, so it's all about how you know the person.
Exactly. To even qualify for a PFA, you, as the victim and the perpetrator, must have a very specific kind of established relationship.
Like, what kind of relationship?
Well, we are talking about family members by blood or marriage, current or former intimate partners, or just people who share a household.
So, like, domestic violence by a spouse. Or stalking by an ex-boyfriend.
Precisely. And a really crucial detail the study aid highlights here is that for a judge to grant a PFA, the abuse does not actually need to be a formalized crime under the penal code.
Oh, wow. Wait, really?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be something the police would arrest someone for on a standard patrol. It covers a much broader spectrum of abusive behaviors that happen within those specific intimate relationships.
Okay, let's unpack this because the second category, the PFSVI, seems to operate under a completely different set of rules.
It really does. PFSVI stands for Protection from Sexual Violence or Intimidation.
And this one is different because of the relationship aspect.
Right, because this shield requires absolutely no qualifying relationship whatsoever.
Not at all.
None. It was specifically designed by the legislature to fill the massive gap left by the PFA. This is the shield you use against strangers.
Or like a hostile coach, maybe.
Yeah, a coach, a predatory coworker, or a classmate. If a total stranger commits a sexual assault, or if a high school coach is actively intimidating a player, that falls squarely under a PFSVI.
Okay, wait, I have to stop you there because I'm looking at this division and, to a layperson, it feels completely counterintuitive.
How do you mean?
Well, if you are terrified for your safety, danger is just danger, right?
No.
Like, whether a brick is thrown through your living room window by your ex-husband or by some completely deranged coworker, the glass shatters exactly the same way.
The physical act is the same, yes.
And your fear is exactly the same. So the key dividing line for the courts isn't necessarily the severity of the physical act itself or the level of threat, but the exact nature of the relationship.
That's right.
Why does the court care who is holding the brick?
What's fascinating here is how the law categorizes and responds to the specific mechanics of risk. It's really about proximity and access.
Proximity and access, okay.
Yeah, yes, danger is danger. But think about it from the court's perspective. An intimate partner or a family member has a profoundly different type of access to your life than a stranger or a coworker does.
How so? Like, logistically.
Logistically and legally. Well, an abusive spouse knows your daily routines, right?
Right, they live with you.
Exactly. They might be on the lease of your apartment. Their name might be on the mortgage. They know exactly where your kids go to school.
They share your bank accounts.
They share the accounts, and they know your emotional vulnerabilities. The legal remedy needed to untangle an abusive spouse from your life is incredibly complex.
Because it touches everything.
Right. It potentially addresses child custody, shared housing, and financial assets all at exactly the same time. The PFA is a heavy, multifaceted tool designed to sever deeply entrenched ties.
Ah, I see. And a stranger doesn't have those ties.
Precisely. The PFSVI, on the other hand, is a sharper, more pointed tool. If a coworker is intimidating you, the court doesn't need to figure out who gets the minivan, you know?
Right. Or where the kids sleep tonight.
Exactly. They just need to create a physical, legal barrier between you and someone who shouldn't be in your personal sphere to begin with. The tool has to match the specific shape of the threat.
Okay, that actually makes perfect sense when you frame it around access. The complexity of the legal shield really just reflects the complexity of the relationship.
Exactly.
So moving on through the source material, let's say you know which shield applies to your situation. You know, whether you need to sever an entrenched tie or just build a wall against a stranger. If you are listening to this right now, the next immediate question you would probably have is, well, who actually has the power to hand you that shield at 2 o'clock in the morning?
And this brings us to the state's built-in after-hours contingency plan.
Right. We're looking at the tension between the magisterial district judges, the MDJs, and the Court of Common Pleas, or the CCP.
And this transition is governed by what the text calls the MDJ high yield rule.
Which sounds very intense.
It is. The rule is incredibly strict. Magisterial district judges absolutely do not handle normal, run-of-the-mill PFAs or PFSVIs.
Like, ever?
Not normally. It is not in their standard job description. Huh? Their involvement is strictly conditional. They only step in when two mandatory conditions are met simultaneously.
Okay. What are the conditions?
First, emergency relief must be needed right now to prevent immediate harm.
Right.
And second, the standard court, the Court of Common Pleas, must be legally classified as unavailable.
Right. And you would naturally think unavailable just means, you know, it's 2 a.m. and the doors are locked.
That's what most people assume.
But the study aid details how the definition of unavailable actually shifts. It depends entirely on the size, geography, and resources of the county you happen to be standing in.
It varies wildly.
So if you are listening to this right now, think about the county you live in. Do you know how many judges sit on your local bench?
Most people don't.
Because at 2 a.m., that number dictates your entire legal reality. The text says that if you are in a smaller county, which the law strictly defines as having fewer than four judges, the CCP is considered unavailable after standard business hours.
Or on weekends.
Right. Or, and this is a massive, or here, if no judge is available because of other duties, illness, or even vacation.
Exactly. Because think about it. In a rural area with only two or three judges total, you have a completely different logistical reality.
Yeah, every judge matters.
Right. One judge taking a scheduled vacation and another suddenly catching the flu could literally paralyze the entire standard legal system for that county.
Because there's no backup.
Exactly. There's no bench depth. So the law says the MDJ can step in even during normal Tuesday afternoon business hours, if that happens.
But then it flips if you are in a larger county.
It does. If you move over to a larger jurisdiction, meaning one with four or more judges, the rules tighten up significantly.
Okay, how so?
In those larger counties, the Court of Common Pleas is only deemed unavailable after business hours and on weekends.
So the vacation thing doesn't apply.
Right. A judge going on vacation in a massive urban courthouse in Philadelphia or Pittsburgh, well, that doesn't trigger the emergency MDJ jurisdiction. Because there are dozens of other judges down the hall to cover the caseload.
Wait, I have to step in here. Because if I am running for my life in the middle of the night, trying to secure legal protection, you're telling me I have to figure out how many judges my county employs before I know which door to knock on.
I know.
That sounds like a bureaucratic nightmare for a victim who is already in a state of absolute panic.
It sounds complex, absolutely. But in practice, the victim isn't expected to memorize county judicial rosters.
Okay, good. Who handles that then?
Local law enforcement, 911 dispatchers, and domestic violence advocates. They are the ones routing victims to the correct on-call MDJ. The complexity is really on the administrative side, just ensuring the system itself is structurally sound.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because it almost sounds like the healthcare system.
Oh, that's an interesting comparison.
Think about it like this. The Court of Common Pleas is basically your primary care doctor.
That's a great way to frame it. And the magisterial district judge is the urgent care clinic, or the ER.
Right. Because you don't go to the ER for a routine physical, a normal checkup, or a minor scrape.
You'd be waiting for hours.
Exactly. You go to your primary care doctor during normal hours for that, which is the CCP. But if you have a life-threatening injury at 3 a.m. on a Sunday, you can't just sit in your living room bleeding, waiting for your primary care doctor's office to open on Monday morning.
No, you definitely don't.
You go to the ER to get stabilized.
And to push that analogy a little further, the ER doctor isn't there to manage your long-term health plan or cure a chronic illness.
Right. They just want to stop the bleeding.
Exactly. They are there to stabilize your vitals and keep you alive until you can see a specialist. That is exactly what the MDJ is doing.
So they aren't fixing the whole situation.
No, they aren't settling your divorce. They are stopping the immediate threat of violence. And what's brilliant about factoring in the number of judges is how beautifully adaptable the law becomes.
It scales to the region.
Right. It automatically adjusts for the vastly different realities of rural versus urban legal systems, ensuring that no matter where you live, there's always an ER open when the primary care clinic is closed.
Okay, so we have our legal emergency room, the MDJ. The next piece of this puzzle is how someone actually walks through those doors and initiates the process.
The logistics of it.
The who, where, and how much of it all. Looking at the documents, the list of who can file a petition is pretty comprehensive. Obviously, an adult can file for themselves.
Right, of course.
It also says an emancipated minor can file independently, and you can also have a guardian ad litem filing for a child. Actually, let's pause.
Sure.
We are throwing around some heavy legal terms here. For someone who hasn't been to law school, what exactly is an emancipated minor, and what is a guardian ad litem?
Fair point. Let's define those. An emancipated minor is someone who's under the age of 18, but has been legally granted the rights of an adult by a court.
Usually because they're married or something?
Yeah, usually because they are completely self-supporting or married. They don't need a parent's permission to file.
Got it. And the guardian ad litem?
A guardian ad litem is a specific legal representative. They're appointed by a court strictly to advocate for the best interests of a child or an incapacitated person during a legal proceeding.
So it's basically a safety net.
Exactly. The law is designed to cast a very wide net. It allows parents, adult household members, or court-appointed advocates to step in and file petitions to protect vulnerable populations who simply cannot advocate for themselves in a crisis.
That makes a lot of sense. And then there's the cost.
Ah, yes. The fees.
The study aid makes this very, very clear. The cost to file this emergency petition is absolutely free.
$0.
$0. There is no filing fee, there is no issuance fee, and there is no registration fee.
Nothing at all.
Now, hold on. I'm looking at the $0 price tag, and my first thought is, isn't this system going to get completely exploited?
That's a common question.
Right, because administrative fees usually exist to act as a kind of friction, right? A speed bump to make people stop and think before they file endless paperwork.
True.
So what does this all mean? Doesn't the total lack of financial friction make it a little too easy for someone to just file a petition on a whim, maybe out of spite against a neighbor they don't like?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's a valid concern from a purely administrative standpoint. But we have to look at the grim reality of domestic violence.
Okay. How does that factor in?
In this context, financial fees are quite literally a deadly barrier to immediate safety. You have to remember that financial abuse is a core systemic component of domestic violence.
Oh, right. The abuser controls the money.
Exactly. An abuser often controls all the money. Mm. The victim might not have access to a single credit card, a checking account, or even cash.
Wow. So if they have to pay.
If a victim finally finds the courage to flee at 2 a.m., but the system demands they scrape together $100 just to buy their physical safety, the system has fundamentally failed them. They would be forced to return to their abuser.
So the state just entirely removes the financial barrier to prevent that trap.
Yes. The state intentionally prioritizes rapid access over administrative convenience.
That's incredibly important.
It is. But to address your point about chaos or frivolous filings, the system doesn't rely on money to prevent exploitation.
What does it rely on then?
It relies on strict venue rules and the judge's rigorous assessment of the evidence to weed out bad faith petitions.
Mm.
The barrier to entry isn't your wallet. It's the evidentiary threshold of imminent harm.
Speaking of those strict venue rules, where do you actually file this paperwork?
That's crucial.
The study aid says you can generally file in the county where you, the plaintiff, currently reside, or in the county where the abuse or violence actually occurred.
That's the general rule.
But there is a very specific, bolded, special venue rule here that caught my eye. It says if the emergency petition specifically requests the possession, use, or occupancy of a residence, the action must be filed in the county where that residence is located.
Right.
Why is that specific rule so rigid?
Because it's a vital jurisdictional boundary. Think about the power the judge is wielding here.
It's a lot of power.
It is.
Yeah.
If an MDJ is going to issue a legally binding order that effectively dictates who is legally allowed to sleep in a specific house tonight.
And conversely, who is legally evicted from that house under threat of arrest.
Exactly. That judge needs to have jurisdiction over the physical dirt that house sits on. A judge in one county cannot blindly start evicting people from properties located in a completely different county.
Okay, we are in the right after-hours court. We've bypassed the financial barriers. We have jurisdiction over the dirt. Now we have to deal with the actual hearing itself. And this is where the documents get into what I think is the trickiest, most sensitive part of this entire system.
It is very sensitive.
How does a judge make a legally binding ruling when only one side of the story is in the room? The study aid calls this an ex parte hearing. What exactly does ex parte mean?
Ex parte is a Latin legal term that simply means from one party.
From one party.
Right. In practice, it means the hearing is conducted with only the plaintiff, the person asking for protection, present in the room. The respondent, the person accused of the abuse or intimidation, is entirely absent.
They aren't even there.
No, they don't have a lawyer there, and they might not even know the hearing is taking place at all.
And the study A highlights that for an MDJ to grant relief in this one-sided ex parte hearing, there must be immediate and present danger, which is legally defined as good cause.
Yes, good cause is the legal standard.
The text gives a few stark examples of what qualifies, like a recent assault coupled with an immediate fear of further harm, a situation where law enforcement is literally advising immediate court intervention or an imminent, highly credible threat of violence.
Correct. Please. And because this is happening, ex parte, because the accused isn't there to defend themselves, the authority granted to the MDJ is strictly and absolutely temporary.
Because it has to be.
Exactly. They are not making a final permanent ruling on the guilt or innocence of the accused.
Okay, I have to push back heavily on the philosophical foundation of this.
I expected you might.
Look, I understand the need for safety, but isn't the absolute bedrock of the entire American justice system the right to face your accuser?
It is a fundamental right, yes.
The right to hear both sides of a story before the state takes action against you? Even if you call it temporary, an emergency order can kick someone out of their own home, prevent them from seeing their children, and completely upend their life without them ever saying a single word in their own defense.
It's severe.
What if the plaintiff is lying? How do we justify stripping away someone's constitutional rights based on a totally one-sided conversation at 3 a.m?
This raises an important question, and it is the ultimate collision of competing rights. It is the exact constitutional dilemma that legal scholars have debated for decades.
I'm sure they have.
How do you balance due process with the right to simply survive the night? The source material actually resolves this tension by pointing to a fundamental legal philosophy. Justice delayed can be justice denied.
Meaning what exactly in this context?
Meaning if a judge forces a victim of severe domestic violence to wait until the respondent can be properly found, served with paperwork, and brought into a courtroom for a fair, balanced debate, the victim might literally not survive to see that court date.
Ah, so a fair hearing doesn't do you any good if you're not around to attend it.
Precisely. The system justifies this temporary suspension of standard due process by tightly restricting the scope of the MDJ's power.
By keeping it temporary.
Right. As I said, the MDJ is not deciding the full merits of the case. They aren't issuing a permanent conviction, they aren't permanently altering custody, and they aren't seizing assets forever.
They are just acting as the ER.
Yes, they're simply hitting the pause button on reality. They are freezing the situation, legally separating the volatile elements to prevent irreparable harm, meaning physical injury or death.
But the rights of the respondent aren't just erased, right? They are still woven into the process, just delayed.
Exactly. The respondent must be given notice of this temporary order as soon as practically possible.
So they do find out.
Oh, yes. and they maintain the absolute right to a full comprehensive hearing in the Court of Common Pleas at a later date where they can present evidence, cross-examine witnesses, and defend themselves.
So they get their day in court eventually.
They do. In fact, the text explicitly warns that failure to provide this due process down the line can result in the termination of the protective order entirely. The Court of Common Pleas is where the pause button is released and where constitutional due process is ultimately preserved and protected.
So it's a very specific process flow that the study A lays out. First,
okay.
The petition is filed completely free of charge.
Okay.
Second, the MDJ reviews it specifically for that emergency good cause criteria. Third, they hold that ex parte hearing with just the plaintiff.
Yeah.
Fourth, if the criteria are met, they issue a temporary emergency protection order, hitting that pause button. And finally, step five, the absolute second the Court of Common Pleas becomes available again, the entire case is transferred over for a full review.
It is a remarkable piece of civic engineering when you step back and look at it.
It really is.
It recognizes that the rigid, bureaucratic structures of the law must occasionally bend to accommodate the chaotic, unpredictable realities of human violence. But it does so without permanently breaking the constitutional framework of the entire country.
It is a phenomenal balancing act. We've really traced the entire journey today.
We covered a lot of ground.
We started with a midnight emergency, navigated the nuanced difference between needing a shield from an intimate partner versus a stranger, walked into the legal emergency room of the magisterial district judge, bypassed the deadly financial barriers, and secured a temporary ex parte shield, all before transferring the case back to the standard Court of Common Pleas when the sun comes up.
It's a journey.
It perfectly echoes that profound summary from the text. Emergency relief ensures safety today. The Court of Common Pleas ensures justice tomorrow.
It's an elegant summary of a highly complex system. But I think there is one more layer to this that we really need to consider.
Oh, what's that?
Well, it's something the logistical flowchart implies but doesn't explicitly measure. While this legal mechanism is a brilliant logistical solution on paper, we need to pause and ponder the psychological toll this takes in the real world.
What do you mean by the psychological toll?
Consider the immense, almost unimaginable burden placed on the victim. Yes, they navigate the system. Yes, they get a temporary shield in the middle of the night. And yes, they get to survive until morning.
But it's not over.
Far from it. They have to go to sleep with the looming, heavy reality that just a few days later, that temporary shield evaporates.
Oh, wow.
They will have to walk into the Court of Common Pleas, face their abuser in the cold light of day, in a room full of lawyers and clerks, and completely relitigate their entire trauma to secure permanent protection.
That sounds absolutely exhausting.
It's a sobering reminder that behind every perfect logical legal flowchart, there is a deeply complex, exhausting, and ongoing human struggle. Securing that emergency order isn't the end of the nightmare. It's often just the beginning of a very long, very painful legal journey.
That is a heavy but incredibly necessary thought to leave off on. The paperwork might be filed, the temporary safety might be secured, but the human experience of that trauma is just beginning to unfold. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. The next time you walk or drive past a courthouse and think about it being closed for the night, just remember the invisible machinery working in the background to keep the lights on for those who need it most. Stay curious, stay safe, and we will catch you on the next one.